Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Michigan on the broadcast today and the right to work. Getting AOL working again. And crossword puzzles and getting paid for your work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 11th of December. Good as always to have you with us. 9.1%, that is the unemployment rate in the state of Michigan. And I mention it because Michigan is pretty much the center of the American labor story today, organized labor in particular. The legislature there has passed and the governor has signed bills making Michigan a right-to-work state. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk has been in Michigan all week long. Hey, Chrissy.
Hi, Kai.
So listen, you've been out to the state capitol today. What'd you see?
So there have been thousands of people who've gathered on the lawn and steps of the state capitol in freezing cold weather, some flurries of snow, and the great majority of them are here to speak out against the right to work law, which, just to remind people, would make it so that workers couldn't be required to pay union dues or fees, even if they benefit from a union contract.
Yeah. What about supporters of right to work of this legislation? They must be around as well, huh?
Well, they are here across in the state. People are about evenly split for and against bringing a right to work law to Michigan, according to recent polls. So there's plenty of people that do support it, and they say that they hope it will make the state more competitive, draw more companies to set up shop in Michigan if unions are weaker. But those who are for right to work were not out at the state capitol. I did find one lone guy, Lawrence Bates, who was in favor of right to work. He was carrying a sign, and he read it to me.
Freedom plus competition equals dollars or wealth. That's how this country got wealthy in the first place. There's no country in the world that defies people freedom and the ability to compete that remains wealthy.
But that guy was quickly shut down by a woman who walked by and read his sign. Her name was Cheryl Erickson. She's a social worker in a union. And she said she was okay with people not joining a union if they don't want to.
I don't disagree with that, but then maybe they should just work for less money and not have the health care and not have the vacation time and not have the prescription care or the retirement, too, if they don't want to pay to get the benefits. They could have the freedom to do that. That would be okay with me.
What do we actually know, Chrissy, about how right-to-work laws play out in terms of pay and benefits and all that?
Well, the research is really mixed. So Michigan would be the 24th state to become right to work. And if you look at the 23 that already are, you can see the numbers in lots of different ways. There's some indication that becoming a right to work state does draw some more jobs, though economists say it's not that many. And there are also studies that show that right to work states have, on the whole, lower wages than states that have stronger unions. States that are already right to work states are mostly poor states. I talked to a professor of economics named Charles Ballard at Michigan State University, and he said that actually all the focus on right to work is kind of missing the point. For one, the vast majority of workers in Michigan and around the country are already not members of unions.
Right to work is a distraction. It won't hurt a tremendous amount. We may be able to get a few more low-wage jobs. But the real secret to prosperity for the future is having a more highly educated workforce.
And Ballard says he'd rather focus on how to do that than get bogged down in this right-to-work debate.
A debate that's playing out in Lansing, in Michigan today. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk is out there. Chrissy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
On the other big story that's out there, the one that won't somehow go away, traders pretty much said fiscal cliff, schmiscal cliff today. They had themselves a fine old time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The phrase I think we're looking for with this next story is return on investment. because as of this morning, you, the American taxpayer, no longer own any part of AIG, the big insurance company that was bailed out back when bailouts were the thing in 2008. $182 billion was the final tally for what we gave them. Today, the Treasury Department said it's officially made that money back and then some, $22 billion in profit overall on the sale of AIG stock. AIG, as you know, was just one bailout of many. In all, they were worth trillions of dollars. So with the caveat that, yes, they did save the economy, might be worth a look at the return on our bailout investment overall, don't you think? Marketplace's David Gura has been keeping score.
AIG's bailout was the big one, the single largest investment the government made. And now, it's history.
I think we should pop the champagne bottles.
Stephen Davidoff is a law professor at Ohio State, and he says that in 2008, no one was talking about turning a profit on these bailouts, many of which were essentially no-interest loans.
We've done much better than people thought we would.
AIG was part of the Toxic Asset Relief Program, or TARP, to throw in another acronym. Michael Barr was an assistant treasury secretary, and he says taxpayers spent about $418 billion bailing out companies like AIG, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs.
More than 90% of that has now been returned to the taxpayer, so $380 billion of that.
The Treasury Department won't say how much all the government bailouts cost. It does say it expects to make a profit on TARP, or at least break even. But Michael Barr, for one, is not breaking out that champagne, at least not yet.
It doesn't mean that we're out of the woods. There's still lots of investments out there in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Taxpayers have spent nearly $200 billion propping up the two mortgage giants, and we're likely to lose money on that. As we go down our bailout scorecard, Stephen Davidoff says we should keep an eye on a few other investments as well.
The automakers, the auto finance companies have not done great.
We got out of Chrysler last year, but we lost more than $1 billion, and we're still part owners of GM and Ally Financial. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Not everybody who's making their way to North Dakota to profit from the oil boom they're having out there is an experienced rigger or roughneck or somebody who's out of work looking to get started all over again. Some of those people are just taking advantage of an opportunity. Independent radio producer Todd Melby is working on a year-long project. It's called Black Gold Boom out of Williston, North Dakota, and we are airing some of his portraits of the people and the places he's run across in his time there. Today, a guy who made a career change to get into big oil.
My name is Daniel Rock. Right now, we're in a really small town in North Dakota. We're in Bell Bells. I've been in Bell Bells for about a week. We found some new housing right here, and we moved up this direction because we're really close to our work assignment. I've been doing this oil field business for about 6 years. I like my schedule of work. We work 2 weeks on and 1 week off, and it's pretty consistent work, and it's a good paycheck, six figures or more. It's way worth it. I gave up a job being a school teacher in Nebraska, and my brother-in-law was doing oil field work back in 2005, and he invited me over to see what he was doing, and it didn't look too hard, so I was like, well, I'm going to put my name on the application list, and I got hired up. I was a school teacher. School teachers make pretty good money, you know. They make about $40,000 or so. And it's pretty rewarding working with kids, but tell you the truth, nothing like doubling your money the first year out. I'm one of the frugal guys, and my guys think that I'm kind of crazy. I bought a Honda Insight, one of the few people that have. It's a hybrid. Yeah, with the hatchback at the back end. I kind of like the smaller, more economical, 50, 60 miles a gallon type of a vehicle. They said, well, you'll work in the oil field, so you should be able to afford a diesel truck. And I know what a diesel truck costs in payments if you wanted to pay it. You know, it's like $1,000 a month. Plus, you got the fuel. And at over $4 a gallon, fuel, it's very expensive on diesel. So I don't see the net need for it. Everybody in my family already has a pickup, so my car suits me just fine. Food situation, yeah. Up here, I saw that there's a Jack and Jill across the street, but in this town, it's closed. And so I saw that there's a farmer using a co-op. It's a gas company, and they're selling gas, and looks like insurance in there, and hopefully they got some food.
Todd Melby's project, it's called Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Local Ore and the Association of Independents in radio. Help me out, will you? What's a nine-letter word for shot in the dark?
No one is commissioning crosswords. You're sending them in and hoping that the editor will like them.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 78 points today, 0.6%, finished at 13,248. That erases its post-election losses by the by. The NASDAQ scored 35 points, more than 1%, wrapped up at 3,022. The S&P 500 up 0.2%, 9 points, 1,427. Morgan Stanley jumped more than 4% today. Goldman Sachs tacked on 1.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase bumped up about 0.75%. Delta Airlines is flying 5% higher today after agreeing to buy a 49% share of Virgin Atlantic. Apple led the tech sector, gained 2%. As we mentioned, the government is unloading its stock in American International Group, AIG. And as the Feds pulled out, buyers piled on. AIG up more than 5.5% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for November. The International Energy Agency issues its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And get the lowdown on galaxies that formed 13 billion years ago. NASA holds a conference on the latest findings from the Hubble telescope. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Okay, consider for a moment the paradox of AOL, the company that arguably taught America how to use email, but whose name is synonymous when put alongside Time Warner with business deals gone horribly, horribly wrong. Not for the first time, AOL is in the middle of a big push to restructure and rebrand. Tim Armstrong is in charge of things. He's been the CEO of AOL since 2009. Welcome to the program.
Kai, thanks for having me on.
So I'll tell you, I was amazed to discover as I was getting ready to talk to you that AOL stock is up something like 120% over the past year.
We've had a very successful run as a company, and we're in the middle of one of the most difficult turnarounds in probably corporate history, and so it's taken a little bit of time, but most major turnarounds take between 4 and 7 years. We're 3 years in and feel really good about where we are.
You know, I get that, and I completely appreciate how long it takes to turn a company around, especially a company the size of AOL. But I wonder whether it's not true that pretty much anybody who's listening to this interview, the first thing they're going to think of when you hear AOL is going to be this.
You've got mail.
I mean, right?
Wait, look, email is one of the most important services in the world. AOL is the company that taught people about email. I think most people use AOL every day right now. They don't know they use it. We own the Huffington Post and TechCrunch and MapQuest and MoviePhone. And locally in 900 towns, we own a site called Patch. That's part of our story for the future.
Do you have a branding problem then?
We have something that we've been working on. We will be coming out in 2013 to tell people about the AOL brand. I think it'll be powerful, and it will really remind people of AOL, but also make them think about what the AOL of today is.
Well, you were supposed to roll out a big ad campaign yesterday, last night on Monday Night Football. You didn't. I read an Ad Age this morning. It's because you guys had some creative disagreements. What does it say that you can't really get your stuff together to get an ad campaign out if you're trying to rebrand this whole company?
Yeah, well, we, just to be clear about it, this Q4, we started working on a brand campaign. And, you know, my job at the company is to hold the threshold of quality and excellence and doing things that are spectacular. And I think that's what you'll see in 2013.
Let me try this again about that ad that was supposed to roll out last night. I read an Ad Age this morning that you were so involved in this thing that you actually went to auditions for dancers for this ad campaign. And I wonder, with all respect, if you don't have better things to do with your time than go to dancer auditions.
Well, I think, you know, nothing's more important to us than our consumers. Part of the brand campaign that we have been working on is actually putting our real consumers in commercials, and I saw 1,000 AOL consumers, you know, come into our building. And I think any successful business, whether you're the CEO or whether you're the first day on the job, understanding the consumers that you deal with is probably the most important thing you can do. So I only spend my time on things that are going to add huge value to the company, and I think that was a good use of time.
I want to try something with you that I tried with Meg Whitman a couple of weeks ago. She is, of course, the CEO of HP, and I asked her to describe for me in 5 words what her company is. It's your turn. Go ahead.
AOL will be the best connected, most shared, and most impactful brand and media company and with a technology platform in the world.
Okay, so she couldn't do it in 5 words either. I'm going to give you another whack at the apple here. Go ahead.
The best media and technology brand company in the world.
All right. What was that, like 8 maybe?
I don't know.
That was pretty close.
That was pretty close.
Tim Armstrong, he's the CEO of AOL. Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, thanks.
The healthcare news du jour, using a pretty broad definition of du jour, I grant you, is the continuing evolution of Obamacare. But big pharmaceutical companies have some other things on their minds as well. Patents, for one. A lot of name brand blockbuster drugs have lost their patent protections this year. And today, the side effects hit online health information website WebMD. It's going to cut 14% of its workforce as it struggles with a loss of ad revenue for those brand name drugs. And as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports, WebMD has a rival that you might not expect.
WebMD has been around since the dot-com era, and it's commanded some of the highest advertising rates among websites. Every month, around 100 million users click on close to a billion of the site's webpages, and many of those visitors are well-heeled baby boomers. But lately, a growing share of people looking for health information has been going elsewhere. James Unland is the editor of the Health Finance Journal.
I mean, it's just amazing the proliferation of good, free information for consumers.
So which website are people trusting for their vital health information? A survey by the healthcare data firm National Research found that 96% of those asked use Facebook. That's right, Facebook, to find information about healthcare.
Facebook has become the go-to place for a lot of people to put, a lot of organizations to put their presence on the web, for better or for worse.
The competition also comes from YouTube. 28% of those surveyed search out health information there, and another 22% use Twitter. At the same time, you could say the meds have stopped working for WebMD. As patents for such popular drugs as Lipitor have expired, the big drug makers have been doing less advertising. And John Mack, who writes the pharma marketing blog, says they've focused what money they are budgeting on old media.
There's a lot of spending on television and not so much on online spending by the pharmaceutical industry.
Mack says that could change with more drugs for diabetes and obesity in the pipeline, but WebMD will have to fight for a smaller dose of those profits. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Should you be in need of an update on the global petroleum situation, here you go. The average price for a gallon of unleaded gas in this country is $3.32. Internationally, North Sea Brent crude oil goes for about $108 a barrel. So as OPEC gets set to meet in Vienna, no tears will be shed for them at those prices. But the Energy Times, as we've told you, are a change in the world's big new supplier. North America may soon cut into OPEC's profits. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has the latest in a recurring theme, America as petrostate.
If you think of the world oil market as a big stack to be filled, North America is suddenly pouring in big amounts, thanks to new drilling technologies like hydraulic fracturing. In just 2 years, it's begun to disrupt other suppliers, says Jamie Webster at PFC Energy. He's in Vienna for the OPEC meeting.
Because the United States and Canada has kind of filled up that stack, it has reduced the amount that OPEC needs to bring on. So that is why the boom in the United States is, in fact, already affecting OPEC.
It suggests less revenue for countries like Saudi Arabia. But Saudi always matters. It's the world's key swing producer to tighten or loosen supplies when needed. Economist Fatih Birol is with the International Energy Agency.
Saudi Arabia will be still the, if I may say it so, the central banker of the oil industry for many years to come.
Birol thinks Middle East oil shipments to America will soon dwindle to zero. So, how much should Washington care about the Middle East? The not-so-much camp wants a downsized Pentagon budget to reflect that. But Ed Chow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies sees it differently. He says the U.S. remains the world's energy policeman.
There is no substitute for the Middle East for oil, and there's no substitute for American military power to secure that supply of oil for the world economy.
If the U.S. is a winner in the new energy order, Russia may be a loser. Its natural gas stranglehold on the European market is threatened by new shale gas supplies from elsewhere. And China? Its energy thirst makes it increasingly dependent on Middle East oil. Robert McNally is with the Rapidan Group.
This is why China is building a navy that can roam further than its territory and building alliances with countries along the way to the Middle East.
Now, the U.S. production stirring up all this talk has uncertainties. How safe is it to drill? How quickly do the wells decline? Regardless, OPEC thinks the world's energy music is already changing and is trying to dance along. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This next item is going to rub a lot of people the wrong way, so I'm just going to go ahead and say it nice and easy. Every year, more than 100,000 American horses are sent abroad as food. Thing is, since we don't eat a lot of horse meat here, a lot of those animals have drugs in them that aren't fit for human consumption. From Latitude News, Jack Rodolico reports.
Ken Terpenning has owned over 24 racehorses, but one of them made a big impression.
Silky Shark was everything you want in a racehorse. He was vibrant, fiery, a very happy horse. And then on the racetrack, he earned over $100,000 career-wise.
Special winner of the ninth race, number one, Silky Shark.
When Terpenning fell on tough times, he sold Silky Shark to a man he trusted. But then the horse was resold again and again, going from Lexington, Kentucky to a Canadian slaughterhouse. It's perfectly legal to flip horses in this manner, but here's the problem. Silky Shark was given a drug that's beneficial for horses, but a carcinogen for humans. Seneca Crossland with the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition says her country isn't protecting consumers from tainted meat.
Horses have not been raised as livestock. You know, they're given drugs when they need them. People aren't holding back.
But who eats horse meat anyway? Belgium, France, and Italy. The European Union is the primary market for American horses slaughtered in Canada. Dan Jorgensen is a member of the European Parliament.
Well, I think it's quite concerning that European consumers might actually be buying and, well, eating horse meat that we don't really have any reason to believe is healthy.
Jorgensen says the EU's laws are strict, but enforcement just hasn't happened. He wants to pressure Canadians to stop letting tainted meat from slipping through the system. Until that happens, more than 1,000 American horses a week will be slaughtered in Canada. Horses like Silky Shark. Back in Lexington, Kentucky, Ken Terpenning is waiting for someone to regulate the system.
I just wish it was done. You know, I look at his pictures on my wall every day, and I just still can't believe it.
I'm Jack Rodolico for Marketplace.
Jack's story came to us with support from PRX and the Open Society Foundations. A lot of people like a good crossword puzzle to challenge themselves. But for those who build those puzzles, construct is the technical term, the challenge is often financial. Ben Taussig is a puzzle constructor. He is also the editor of the American Values Club crossword. And he wrote at theall.com the other day about the pains of making a living trying to do the Sunday crossword puzzle. Ben, it's good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let me ask how it works. I mean, when you decide to create a crossword, you draft one and then you send it off to, I don't know, Will Shorts at the Times and say, here you go, I hope you like it?
That's right. That's pretty much how it works.
That's a lousy business model, dude.
They're entirely written on spec. So no one is commissioning crosswords. You're sending them in and hoping that the editor will like them. And depending on the outlet, often waiting a very long time before you hear back.
Like how long?
You know, the average for the New York Times is probably somewhere between 4 months and a year. Wow. One constructor recently, however, had an amazing story. He received an acceptance letter for a crossword puzzle that he had submitted in 2001. And this is a couple of months ago.
Wow. So how much, assuming Mr. Shorts buys my puzzle, how much will the New York Times pay me?
Shorts is comparatively generous. He pays $200 for a weekday puzzle and $1,000 for a Sunday puzzle, which is far and away the best in the business. There are a number of other outlets that pay $60, $80 for a daily puzzle or $200 for a Sunday. And we're talking about quite a bit of work.
Well, that's the next question, right? How long – once you get your, you know, your grid set up on the paper, how long does it take you to make a puzzle?
You know, it's possible for a daily crossword to be finished in, you know, let's say 4 or 5 hours if you're good. Hmm. But really what the value of a crossword is in the idea, the theme. Most crossword puzzles mm-hmm. are themed. Mm-hmm. And coming up with an original theme is quite difficult, not to mention coming up with good entries for the theme. And then you put this thing out there that makes lots of money for the paper, and your compensation is quite low.
You know, we keep beating up on Will Shortz in the New York Times, but is it fair to say that he has done more to popularize the crossword in this country than a whole lot of people recently?
It's very fair. And actually, I don't mean to beat up on Will Shortz.
Yeah, no, that was me doing the beating up. So.
No, he's a friend of mine, and he is actually a great advocate for better constructor pay. And he's worked very, very hard at the Times to increase rates. He is absolutely not the source of the problem. It's the paper itself that has been resistant to suggestions that they improve constructor pay. And frankly, part of the reason for that is that there hasn't been much pressure. So part of the answer to the inequity in crossword puzzles is also to come up with alternatives that are viable and that can, in fact, compete with an outlet like the New York Times.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. Are you one of those who crosses out the clues as you fill in the crossword puzzle?
No. I graduated from that a long time ago.
All right. There you go. That's one of my pet peeves about crossword puzzles. Anyway. Ben Taussig, he runs something called the American Values Crossword Club. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you can try one of Ben's puzzles for yourself. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which one can only file under what is the matter with people. I don't know if you heard about the fancy new Starbucks card last week. It's made of etched steel, costs $50, and you can load it up with $400 worth of coffee goodness. But that, believe it or not, is not the ridiculous part. There are bids for these things on eBay for close to $1,000. $980 was the highest I saw. Then again, this is the company that has convinced us, yours truly included, to pay $4 for a cup of coffee. So there's that. All right, that's it. We got to go. Marketplace from APM is the show. Today, the Dow up 78 points. The NASDAQ gained 35 points. The S&P 500 up about 9 points. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.